We'd like to start this month with a quick apology to any of you who tried to download or listen online to last month's podcast and were met with a plea for donations. We forgot to put some money in the meter that keeps the internet running. If you enjoy the podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes, but Gascast has always been and will always be free to download, free to listen online to, and free from copyright. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this month's episode.
Hello and welcome to Gascast. This month we're going to attempt to inject some common sense into antibiotic prescribing, get a spine-tingling blast from the past, and evaluate a rather headline-grabbing paper from this month's anaesthesia. We'll also nerd out how some discoveries, games, and plenty more. I'm Rick Thomas, and back with me are Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
Mark Salmon.
Hello.
And Frank Schneider.
Hi, everyone.
So, Bex, nice to have you back after we missed you last month.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back.
We did. It was very testosterone heavy, Bex.
Yes, let me give my delicate touch to this podcast.
It certainly was. Thank you very much to Sibs for filling in, and I'm sure we will have him back in the near future. But Bex, why don't you kick us off by telling us what you've been up to this month?
So my discovery is to do with a patient that had intracranial hypertension, the benign intracranial hypertension, or they call it here the pseudo-tumor cerebri. This is typically occurs in obese females of childbearing age. So you can imagine in my current job, I see quite a lot of people with this. And one of these ladies presented to the high-risk obstetric clinic, and she's booked for an elective section for a fetal reason. And I was just about to consent her for her spinal when she said to me, "Oh, yes, and you'll be doing the epidural like my neurologist told me." And I said to her, no, we're going to do a spinal. And then she corrected me and she said to me,
"Thank
no,
God.
We were going to do an epidural because," and she could have a spinal for a benign raised intracranial hypertension because they have no pathology. So they're very safe to have spinals. However, she had a lumboperitoneal shunt. And so if I'd given her any medication into the CSF of the back, it just apparently redistributes in the abdomen. And the spinal only lasts about 10 or 15 minutes. So her and her neurologist were entirely correct. And she had a very safe epidural subsequently at the space above where her shunt was inserted. So it was quite an interesting discovery for me.
That is good to know.
It is, isn't it? Because there's actually no reason, if she hadn't had a shunt, that she can't have a spinal.
But they do the spinals therapeutically anyway, don't they?
Yeah, exactly.
I had a niece as a kid who came in for repeated spinals, and he had opening pressures of like 80 centimetres of water or something. And yeah, as you say, I mean, they'd take 30, 40 mils out, and then he'd come back again a few days later.
Yeah.
What size was his head?
It wasn't that big, actually, but he was getting some nasty headaches.
Poor man. Anyway, yeah, that was that.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for that. I'm bursting to tell you about mine, because I only just discovered it.
Go with your bad self.
If, like me, you can't stop watching, and you may know her, Bex, Canadian songstress Carly Rae Jepsen on YouTube, but you're annoyed by the constant stream of enforced video ads for trips to Disneyland and the new Girls Aloud Greatest Hits album, and I've got fantastic news. About 20 minutes ago, before we started recording, I discovered the Adblock Plus extension for Firefox. It totally gets rid of banner and the enforced video ads, which is totally magical. I realise I'm probably a bit slow to that party, but it's yet another two thumbs up win for open source software.
But so bans ads, well, the ads at the beginning of YouTube clips, for example.
Right, so not only does it get rid of that banner ad that you have to click on,
yeah,
but you know how if you've been watching serial YouTube clips,
yeah,
every two or so clips it'll give you an advert?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
I am going to go and download that right away.
It will go straight to the one, to whatever it was you asked for.
So,
and
just
this little thing says block.
Okay, so for the computer illiterate on us, just tell me how to do that exactly.
So if
it's
you...
impossible.
Well, Frank better pay attention so he can do it for me, yeah?
So use Firefox and whatever operating system it is you're using, and you just go Tools, Add-ons, look for AdBlock Plus, install, and just with the default configuration, it'll block all the YouTube stuff, which is fantastic. Ooh.
So, Rick, more importantly, which is your favourite version of the Carly Rae Jepsen ripoff, say?
I haven't actually watched that. I've been more watching the Gangnam Style ripoffs.
Yeah.
I did actually manage to get Gangnam Style into a presentation I did last week.
Are those the Eton boys?
Yeah, the Eton Style one's quite funny. But I was doing a presentation on a patient who I'd seen who had been stomped on by a horse. And my first line was mechanism of injury, stomped on head by horse, brackets Gangnam Style. It got a surprisingly big laugh. So I was pleased with that. But anyway, on to my proper discovery, which is a follow-up on the interview we did back in February with Andrew Morley. About 2 weeks ago, I got a very exclusive invitation through my letterbox to the opening of an exhibition at the Science Museum. You may remember that Andrew was helping to create a Wellcome Trust-sponsored exhibition in the Antenna Gallery at the Science Museum, looking at the cutting edge of anaesthesia and related fields. The project was originally called Senseless, but since we last talked to him, the name of the exhibit has changed to Painless, as the focus shifted more towards pain research. Anyway, it was a fantastic evening, putting anaesthesia and pain medicine right into the public eye. The exhibits are mainly video-based, and not being a pain person, there was really interesting stuff that I wasn't aware of. For instance, I had no idea, but apparently snake, scorpion, spider, and oddly snail venom all block a certain type of sodium channel that are very much being actively researched as future analgesic solutions. It's not just pain, however, and I won't tell you what happens, but there's a really great video of Andrew demonstrating propofol-induced amnesia. I got a chance to speak to Andrew at the event, and it sounds like he's got some really interesting genetic-based research coming out soon, and I made him promise me an interview for Gascast, hopefully early next year. Links to the exhibition website and video game Ouch they've created will all be on the website after this. So if you guys are around and in the area of South Kensington, well worth a visit.
When's it on till?
It is on till November 2013.
Oh, sweet. I'll probably get there.
I can't believe I was there on Tuesday and didn't see it.
It's right at the back on the ground floor. So you've got to go all the way through to where the cafe is, and that's the Antenna Gallery. It's on the right as you walk in. It's not a massive exhibition. It's kind of like one side of one wall. But I think that's the way the Antenna Gallery kind of operates. Anyway, so moving around, Mark, have you got a different exhibition related discovery for us then?
No, I've got a good old fashioned ODP trick fresh from the anaesthetic room. So I'm sure all of you like me will have been frustrated when doing occasional orthopedics and you discover that your surgeon has learnt a second antibiotic and and asks you for some teicoplanin. If you're behind the curve on this one, it's a real pain to try and get it mixed up and ready before the knife to skin, because as I'm sure you know, that stuff does not dissolve very easily at all, and if you try to shake it, then you get an ampule full of froth which never goes away. But an ODP I worked with recently showed me a trick to get it to dissolve more rapidly without creating froth. Any suggestions, any guesses, any ideas what this might be?
Are you at Guildford?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think they just take the plain, they make a hole with a needle, and then you just use a syringe without the needle on it, don't you?
No.
That would cause
that's
a lot
that's
of
a certain fame. ODP has showed me that, from Guildford.
Well, that works for almost any antibiotic. You can do that with Kef.
No, it's almost more sciencey than that.
But they've written it up using the shaver heads, the disposable shaver heads.
Oh yeah, that's it. Is that somebody already written that up?
Yeah, that's a letter in anaesthesia, isn't it?
Yeah. What do they do?
It does work really well though. Sorry, I didn't mean to take a window of your sails, Mark.
No, that's fine. I'm pleased somebody else has shared that with the scientific community.
So for the listener community, could you please describe the technique?
Yeah, so you get the battery operated skin shaver used for patients with a disposable head, and if you just use it without a head and hold the base of that against the ampule, it buzzes, vibrates, just enough to speed up the dissolving of the teicoplanin, but
oh,
without creating froth.
Oh, I like that. I'll
give
it a go.
Micro agitation.
Yeah, it does work really well. For anyone who needs, because we used to give it routinely for cardiac prophylaxis or cardiac surgery prophylaxis, and it is a real pain to draw up.
Mm. I look forward to trying it. I think the surgeons here only seem to know ANSEF, which is one of the cephalosporins. So we just give 2 grams of ANSEF stat to everybody.
And Frank, to round off our discoveries this month.
I've got 2 quick discoveries. One's a nod to Bex with your impending return to the UK, Bex, and your penchant for obstetric anaesthesia. You'll be very pleased to know that in the Telegraph this week, I think, they reported that fathers-to-be are to join partners in birthing pools. So in a government scheme that's spending somewhere around £25 million to make maternity units more welcoming for families, they're now allowing dads to join their partners in birthing pools so that they won't feel excluded in the whole birthing process.
Well, as long as they give them the poop scoop, that's fine.
Yeah, well, awesome. Yeah, they didn't comment on whether or not pooper scoopers would be included.
That's weird. That's one of those situations where I wouldn't be sure as to whether or not I should wear swimming trunks.
I was just about to ask that.
Because I don't know.
I would wear a wetsuit. You're going to be in there with amniotic fluid, meconium. That's disgusting. I would be so far out of that pool if I was the partner.
Well, you see, my thinking is now not only you can have a naked woman and crashing baby to deal with, but you can have naked dad floating around in the birthing pool when you get called to a obstetric emergency in the birthing unit.
Yeah, it's a danger. Because I'm working in the heart of Surrey now, there are quite a lot of new age middle class types, so I'm sure they will want to be naked and covered in goo, just like their wives. The amount of times I walk into a room to do an epidural and the lady's just fully naked. Only at 3 centimetres, but she's ready to go.
It's been a long time since I've done obstetrics.
Oh, the unnecessary nudity of labour wars.
Now, I do have one other discovery, which is a nod to you, Rick, because I think I seem to remember having this discussion over a refreshing beverage some time ago, and this came through a slightly odd note I saw on the net, but in this season of renewed celebrity and reality TV shows, there was apparently a show in the Netherlands called De Grote Donor Show, which Bex, you might understand, was the big donor show as an organ donation.
Yeah.
And it was actually run for over a couple of episodes, apparently, and caused great uproar in the Dutch community because essentially it was about 3 patients waiting for renal transplants that would compete on the show for a donated kidney. And as you can imagine, had lots of people calling in. As it turns out, the whole show was actually a sham, and it was really just a prolonged sort of ad for increasing awareness for the need for organ donation in Holland. But following on from that discussion, because I first of all read that article thinking it was true, they went on to say that there is actually one country, and only one country in the world, that you can actually sell donated organs. Any guesses?
Oh, I am going to say, I'm going to go Middle Eastern. And I'm going to say Egypt. That's not Middle Eastern, is it? That's North Africa.
North Africa, yeah. I'm going to go with one of the small Eastern European countries like Belarus. Or Latvia is my second choice.
Latvia. Mark, any offers on that?
Brazil.
Brazil? No. Well, Rick, you were the closest. Iran is the only country you're legally allowed to sell an organ. You can get $5,000 for your kidney, and it's a partly government-sponsored program. And one does just have to wonder whether that kind of thing is going to catch on.
Hopefully not.
This is an epic rant of mine. But I'm very much in favour of you should be allowed to sell organs.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I think it needs to be carefully regulated.
Well, apparently Iran has eliminated the shortage of transplant organs through their scheme.
So can you
That's
sell pretty
I
much anything?
That's what I said would happen.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't go on to give details. It just says that you can get $5,000 for a kidney.
$5,000 doesn't seem enough to me.
Well, that's exactly, yeah. I mean, if it was more, then probably I would think about it.
Is that $5,000? Is that $5,000 UK, though?
No, $5,000 US, but keep in mind that the per capita GDP in Iran is 6,000, so...
So that will get you a lot further.
So, yeah, I think in proportion it's a fair bit of money. They don't say how much you get for a heart.
Still doesn't seem like a lot.
It's got to be in the millions, because you've got to think, what worst case scenario is you give your kidney and then you get some sort of sepsis and you're in renal failure, now it's the rest of your life on dialysis. So it'd have to be enough money to support you for the rest of your
life. If that happens, both of your kidneys are going to be in trouble, not just one of them.
Well, surely God gave us two kidneys for a reason, Rick.
Don't start with the God.
You can't answer that. You can't argue with that.
No, I can't. I can't argue with that. That is
without offending my beliefs.
But there's already a lot of redundancy built into kidneys.
Yeah, but I probably don't need all of my liver. I'm not going to donate a lobe to somebody.
Why not? That regenerates. That's just selfish.
Right.
Let's move on, because this is going to get unrecordable fairly fast. So thank you for that, guys, and let's move on to our news items this month. So Bex, why don't we start with you and your electrifying blast from the past about ways to detect correct epidural placement of your catheter?
Yeah, so I am delving back into the 90s, one of my favourite decades.
A great decade for music.
Was Milli Vanilli the 90s? I think he was.
Yeah.
No.
Was it?
Was he?
Maybe he was the 80s. I don't know. It's at least Roxette.
Definitely. Loving a bit of Roxette.
For my news item, I'm going to talk about the TUI test. And this is a test that was developed by Dr. Ban Tsui from Alberta in Canada. And the article was published in the Canadian Journal of Anesthesia in 1998. It's not something that I'd come across ever in the UK, but we actually use the TUI test really frequently here, especially in my current job, where you have those catheters that you consider to be very precious. We do a lot of sort of morbidly obese women with BMIs of 50 or 60, and we don't want to put off to sleep for their cesarean section. And so we want to make sure that our catheter is in the right place, and we do a combined spinal epidural technique as a two-stage procedure. So we have an epidural that we're happy with first, and then we do the spinal. So what this test is, it's really just a modified nerve stimulator. And as Rick says, it's used to confirm the epidural catheter placement. The kit itself is really simple. You just have the nerve stimulator, and it's got two electrodes. It's got the anode, which you place over the patient's deltoid, and it's just secured to the skin with an ECG sticker. And then there's the cathode, which is connected to the epidural catheter, and it's got a special metal adapter so that you can attach it just after you disconnect, where you'd have the filter on the epidural, and you connect the connector of the nerve stimulator there. So to make sure that the apparatus is going to work correctly, you have to make sure that you've flushed your epidural catheter and the connector to your nerve stimulator with saline, which will transmit your current, and you've got to make sure that there's no airlocks. And preferably, for the best results, you use one of those epidural catheters that's got the wire reinforced. So it's a 1 hertz frequency that's used, and the current that you use, you start at 0 milliamps, and then you gradually increase the current. And what you're looking for is either movement in the trunk or the limbs. And once you have motor activity, then you stop increasing the current. So what the positive response is the positive response says that you're in the epidural space. And this positive response is either the trunk movement or the limb movement at a current of between 1 and 10 milliamps. And it can be bilateral, but it can be unilateral, depending on where exactly your catheter is lying. And so you can't predict, you know, if it has gone off to one direction. If you've put in a lumbar epidural, you usually get leg twitching. And if you've put a thoracic epidural in, then you usually look for abdominal wall movement. And typically you get a response at about 3 or 4 milliamps. Now you want to make sure you're not just getting local stimulation from your grounding electrode, that was the one on the deltoid. So once you have got some muscle movement, wherever it is, you typically move your electrode from the deltoid and put it somewhere else and just check the test again and make sure that you get the same motor response. So now that you've confirmed that you're happy, that you've got this either this unilateral or bilateral movement, you give your test dose of your for your epidural. And here we use 3 mils of 2% lidocaine with 1 in 200,000 adrenaline. And then you repeat your test after a couple of minutes. And what you should find is that your threshold to get some motor activity should be increased. So say originally you got a response at 4 milliamps. Now perhaps you'll get it at 6 or 7. And with subsequent doses, while you load your epidural, the motor response will actually go. So if you don't get the limb or truncal movements, you've got a negative response, then you can try and interpret where exactly the catheter is. So if the catheter is intrathecal, your CSF is incredibly good at transmitting a current. So you get a bilateral motor response at a current of less than 1 milliamps. So you're aware that you're intrathecal, and you obviously would either pull your catheter back or re-site it. And your other part is that you may be on the skin side of the ligament and the dura, so you're sort of somewhere between the subcutaneous tissue and the epidural space. And you'll either just get localized twitching on your grounding electrode, so probably at the deltoid, or you only get a response once you've really cranked the current up to more than 10 milliamps. And then interestingly, you can tell if it's intravascular, even if you've had negative aspiration, that you test it, for example, and you get a motor response at, say, 5 milliamps. So you'd get it in that normal range. But once you've given your test dose of lignocaine, the problem is that the lignocaine will be carried away by the bloodstream if it's intravascular, and so you don't get a change in your threshold level. And so your motor response will still happen again at the same current that it originally did. So this Dr. Tui, he did two studies. He did 40 patients that weren't pregnant, and then later he did another 40 of patients that were pregnant. And the test was found to be 100% sensitive and about 91% specific. And yeah, we use it for the catheters that we're very concerned about. So when we do some cases that have really large operations, and like the esophagogastrectomies, where you really want to make sure that your catheter is working. So we use those the test in those patients, and as I said, we use them for the really obese obstetric patients. And they, having a look in the literature, there doesn't seem to be any reported side effects. It's very similar to the spinal cord stimulation that they used for years. There isn't any metal that's in direct contact with the epidural tissue, and there's such a low risk of thermal injury. So yeah, it's quite a great, quite a cool piece of kit. I hadn't seen it in the UK, but it appears to be really common here.
Bex, I read this, and for me, this was much like AdBlock Plus. Why have I not heard about this before?
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing. This is this is fantastic. I've never ever heard of it or seen it in the UK.
But it just makes so much sense because you know where it is, and actually, there's a really good case report of a obstetric patient where they had a really good working epidural and then it didn't work, and they took the TUI test with them and they worked out that this catheter had migrated intravascularly. And I mean, that, you know, could have potentially prevented a death. So I'm really surprised that we don't have it in the UK, especially with all this discussion about test doses and what to give and how, you know, and now we do really have a fantastic test.
My only question is, what I didn't understand from either the description in the paper or your explanation just then is this metal bit down the catheter, because I've never seen an epidural catheter with a metal strip in it.
Oh, so we have the... Which are the ones that you have in the... I can't remember what we have in the UK.
Special catheters. I had to go onto the website, because, yeah, they're Arrow flexi-tip catheters, aren't they?
Flex-tip plus, it says here.
But yeah, they do. If you look at an image of it online, and it's got that sort of metal connector, and it's got something going down the catheter, which you can't really see well in the photo there.
Is that so at x-rays?
Yeah, you can see it on x-rays, and it just reinforces it. So there, the epidural catheters that we have here, you know, the UK, you have, is it Portex, the very stiff plastic ones that have got multi-orifice at the end. So the disadvantage of The ones that we have here is that they are just a single orifice at the end of the catheter, but they are much more flexible and they have an incredibly lower vascular puncture rate. So because they're very malleable and they have a wire that's rolled, it doesn't extend in a long ways direction. It's sort of wrapped around, you remember like those slinkies? I don't know how
You know, like a spring. So it goes in a spiral. It's circumferential to the...
Yeah, exactly. So it's in the actual, in the plastic, it's molded in, and it's this tiny little spiral all the way up the catheter. But it just makes it very, very bendy. And that the advantage of that is you have less vascular puncture. But the disadvantage is that sometimes, unless you put your epidural in a cephalad angle, if you go in at 90 degrees and you're trying to thread past that Huber point of the TUI, they actually concertina inside the TUI needle because they are so flexible. So sometimes you struggle to advance the catheter because they're almost too bendy. So you just have to adapt your technique to go angle up a bit more so they're not going around a 90 degree bend. But they're a really nice catheter to use.
Am I understanding correctly that you could only do this test with that catheter?
No, you can do it with the plain plastic ones.
Because the saline will conduct.
Yeah. But you have to make sure then you don't have any airlocks throughout. So you just have to make sure it's flushed nicely. And obviously you have to make sure you don't flush it with lignocaine. Otherwise that's going to reduce your effect. It's a very cool piece of kit.
Oh, but it must be pretty... I mean, it's obviously popular in Canada because I'm assuming that Sui is Canadian.
He is, so yeah. He's from Alberta.
None of us have heard of it or used it here in the UK. Probably been around of... quite a few hospitals in the London area.
My initial reaction was the same as you guys, that it sounds amazing, but the more I think about it, the less practical use I can see for it, because the majority of times, the only real confirmation of whether your epidural is working or not that matters is the clinical one. If the patient says it's not working, then it doesn't matter what the electrical test showed, you're going to have to do it again. And likewise, if it stops working, you're going to have to pull it out and do it again.
The point is that you want to check a... No, it's not, because you want to check... You want to do this... you want to do a spinal, I don't know, on some BMI lady, she's got a PMI of 70. So the last thing you want to do is a CSC and have an untested epidural where you don't know where that epidural is, because the last thing you want to do is put her off to sleep when they're still trying to find the uterus in an hour's time. So that's exactly when you want to do your... you know, to check where your catheter is. So you don't want to be doing a huge test dose. You're only a loading dose. You only want to do a test dose. So you put it in. We use lidocaine for our epidurals here for topping up. So, you know, even then with lidocaine, with epinephrine that they use here with adrenaline. So even that, like the best block you're going to get is going to be 9 or 10 minutes. That's a long time to stand behind someone's back waiting. And if you're using bupivacaine, you're going to get a surgery, you know, block maybe in 15 minutes. That's a huge amount of time to wait. Then you've got this patient who's got an epidural block that's sitting up, you know, but you don't think it's significant enough that you're going to have, you know, you're going to have to add in a spinal as well. So that's the perfect time. You put your epidural in, you can tell within about 20 seconds where it is, as opposed to waiting for 15 minutes.
That's not the same as knowing that it works, though, for me. Yeah, that's not good enough to proceed with the surgery. You still got to...
It does tell you it's in the right place. I mean, it kind of has to be if you have that response to stimulation.
It is, but again, I think that's the academic right place. Rather, the patient doesn't care.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you entirely.
What the electrical twitchy test tells you if it still hurts.
Mm-hmm. So moving away from obstetrics, what about your esophagogastrectomy patients or, you know, major abdominal surgery that they're doing, really, you know, liver resections, those kind of patients, where you really want that catheter to work. You've had a difficult placement and you'd like to check that it's working before you put them off to sleep.
Those are the ones who it's difficult to qualitatively assess because you are going to put them to sleep.
And you don't load it. That's a decent example.
You're just swayed by the obstetrics. So we'll talk about a general surgery example. Yeah, so those really, you know, that's exactly when you really value that catheter, they must have it for their post-op recovery. And if you've struggled to put it in, you know, and you don't want to go poking around in the back too much. So I think it's fantastic.
And do you select your patients? So you don't do it routinely, presumably. You just do it in High BMI obstetric patients are always at risk of dural suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, those are the ones I've used it for. It's the people with really bad scoliosis. We've had a lot of people with achondroplasia or people with really bad ankylosing spondylitis where you struggle to put the catheter in or you're actually even aiming to put an intrathecal catheter. And then we use the TUI test to determine where it is before we give them a dose. Because if you're aiming for an intrathecal catheter, you know, you want to confirm that it is before you give a large dose, or you know, if you're hoping that it will be epidural and you think it may have gone intrathecal, you can tell at least where it is. With high-risk patients that you may not necessarily want to put off to sleep. So we have one dedicated to the labor and delivery floor, and we have one dedicated to the main floor, and it's probably used, well, certainly in where I'm working at the moment, for pretty much every thoracic epidural we've put in.
Oh, really?
We check it, yeah.
Just rewinding for 1 second there, exactly how many achondroplastic epidurals do you have on your logbook?
4, I think.
Did you get some kind of prize or badge if you reach 7?
I don't think I've ever done a dwarf epidural.
We have people that may, like really bad anxpond that are, you know, almost curled over completely in a letter C. People with really bad rheumatoid arthritis that are totally not well-shapen.
Again, though, I'm going to have to argue that this test doesn't make it any easier to put those epidurals in. And you've got to have an idea when you've done it, whether it's in or not, surely.
Absolutely. But don't you like to check?
I've never had the
option.
I mean,
it does give you the confidence that your epidural is going to work postoperatively, which is what you're trying to confirm. But I suppose the rest of us just put the epidural in, don't check, and if it's not working post-op, they get a PCA.
Yeah, but I just think for example, for an intravascular catheter, you know, if you did have it routinely, if you had it routinely available and you just checked and you were happy that things weren't intravascular, even if you just saved one death in your anaesthetic career, isn't that quite quite significant?
How many deaths have you had?
Mark, I'll get you one day.
I'm going to talk to the esophagogastric people I'm working with next week. And see if they've come across this and why we don't have it in this country.
I think that's a very good question. And whatever your opinion, it's definitely a nice blend of physics and neuroanatomy. Mm. And something that just, you know, none of us have seen in this country. So I look forward to you bringing that back, Bex. And this,
they'll probably notice
the paper which we'll link to is from 1998. So yeah. It'd be great to have some new literature on the subject.
I shall introduce it to the UK on my return.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for that, Bex. That was very interesting. Moving round, this month I'm going to be very much clinically focused, looking at an article from this month's Anaesthesia. This paper is the third in a series of articles by Australian anaesthetist David Canty, looking at focused echocardiography in hip fracture patients. Hip fracture is a common geriatric pathology, and surgery for neck of femur is subsequently a common in-hospital procedure. We're all aware of the disparity in long-term outcomes from this fracture as opposed to most other limb fractures, but by way of a reminder, the one-year mortality is often quoted as 20-25%, with a diagnosis of congestive cardiac failure increasing mortality 14-fold. The introduction to the paper cites many of the diagnostic challenges associated with picking up clinical signs and symptoms in this group of patients, such as dementia, immobility, and reliance on junior medical staff to prepare these patients for surgery. Due to the known increase in mortality associated with delays in surgery, there is frequently an urgency to get these patients into theatres, and these patients certainly do not get anything like the detailed workup that cancer surgery patients receive. However, ringing in my ears whilst I read this was the AAGBI's recent Management of Proximal Femoral Fractures list of unacceptable reasons for delay in taking these patients to surgery, awaiting echocardiography being the number 2 after lack of theatre space. So what's the answer? Canty et al. Proposed that anaesthetist-performed echo is the answer, and in previous papers have demonstrated it to be feasible and to influence patient management. Now, in this paper, they present data to show it affects both medium and long-term outcome, an extremely bold claim. So let's briefly talk about focused ultrasound examination. This is a very vogue concept and something that we've discussed in many guises on this podcast before. Probably the most focused ultrasound I can think of is its use to assist in central venous cannulation. It's focused in the sense that the level of operator knowledge of both the anatomy and process of scanning the intended site is really pretty limited. Compare this with the requirements of getting BSE accredited to perform TTE or TOE, which I'm sure you'll agree, Frank, are pretty onerous. Focused examination is grounded in performing a reproducible, quick exam looking to identify a limited number of specific pathologies. Examples that you may have heard of include FAST, FEEL, and RUSH. In fact, creating your own ultrasound examination is something of a booming business, and the examination used in this paper is the heart scan method. I haven't got a complete description of the exam, but what it aims to pick up are valvular lesions whilst assessing ventricular function and filling status. The subsequent changes in management that the examination can lead to include volume replacement most commonly, rational use of invasive monitoring and vasopressors, and of course ICU. Apparently, pre-op hypovolemia is reported to occur in up to 50% of NOF patients due to an arid combination of bleeding from the fracture, reduced oral intake due to immobility and hospitalisation, and reluctance by staff to give parenteral fluids due to fear of causing pulmonary edema. Before we consider the results of this paper, it's important to put them into the context of the methodology. As it says on the tin, this is a retrospective cohort analysis, which is a fair distance down the evidence-based hierarchy. The fact that it is retrospective is also, in my humble opinion, fairly key, something demonstrated by the fact this paper did not require ethical approval. The treatment cohort was made up from patients borrowed from two other papers where the authors had conducted preoperative focused TTE for hip fracture surgery. The retrospective control cohort was made up from a similar number of patients who underwent the same surgery in the same centres. They've gone to some trouble to reduce inclusion bias by blinding researchers and some randomisation in selection of appropriate cases. However, one of the obvious biases you will not be able to account for is that the patients in the treatment group have already been identified as potentially having a problem and are being managed by an anaesthetist who is, by virtue of having been on the course, interested in these particular patients with these particular problems, and is anaesthetising the patient for inclusion in a research study where management and results are necessarily scrutinised. Similarly, we have no data about the timings, procedural anaesthetic details, and experience or grade of surgeon slash anaesthetist delivering care in the cohort group. With this in mind, the results are certainly very interesting. The 30-day mortality in the TTE group was 4.7% compared to 15.2% in the cohort group, and 12-month mortality was 17.1% versus 33.3%. These figures are quite striking, and what is even more attention-grabbing is the fact that this has reached statistical significance with comparatively small numbers, 64 and 66, for such an ambitious primary outcome. These headline figures are really quite dramatic, but before we start insisting that every NOF patient gets some form of echo, we need to be mindful of the methodology. This study shows proof of concept that preoperative goal-focused TTE may reduce mortality in patients undergoing fractured neck of femur surgery, and I certainly wouldn't say it does more than that. What will be really interesting is what I'm sure the authors are already working on, is an RCT to prove this impressive outcome benefit.
I think if that is repeatable, if their data is reproducible and there are those kind of different diagnostic, you know, things being picked up, and it looks to me like another huge amount of work, paperwork, another obligatory thing we're going to have to add like another string to our bows, because how can you, if you have this kind of data showing this kind of impact, how can we ignore it? I think all of anaesthesia is going to have to be able to do perioperative TTEs, aren't we?
I see. I really like the concept of focused ultrasound. I find, and Frank, I said, have you done, you must be accrediting in TOE.
Well, I'm trying very hard, not going very well at the moment, but yeah, I agree. I mean, I completely agree with you. I think the proper full accreditation courses, be that TTE or TOE, are quite onerous. They involve gathering a lot of cases. And I think the focused ultrasound courses, you know, whichever one you do, and many of them are slightly different because they have slightly different emphasis on either ICU or, you know, fast scan and A&E or whatever it is. So I think candidates go for the one that's most applicable to their field of practice. But I think those are a lot easier to attain. The degree of skill and knowledge you need to answer the specific clinical question you're looking to answer. And clearly in these cases, it's, you know, obvious signs of heart failure, cardiac dysfunction, or valvular pathology.
It worries me that these are kind of quick fix solutions, these focused ultrasounds, though. I mean, there's a good reason why your accredited courses are so difficult to achieve, and why radiology is an entire specialty of its own. And I know from friends and colleagues in radiology that they view us messing about with scanners in the same way that we might view our emergency department colleagues messing about with propofol and laryngoscopes.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. But I think all of these courses, and certainly any I've been on Feel UK, which is the sort of focused echo in life resuscitation, and yeah, the first thing they tell you is, you know, you're just looking to be able to recognise these four things, and you're not being taught to do anything else. And like with TOE as well, you know, you're only supposed to be able to recognise something that you may not understand or may not recognize as normal, and that should then warrant a referral to a radiologist or a cardiologist to do a proper full scan.
Yeah, so if you retain insight, they're probably very helpful, but it's if you have delusions of grandeur, you probably do more damage than good.
So for this example with the hip fractures, if they're showing that a focused TTE is better in hip fracture patients, then surely it would be better to build into your hip pathway that all of these at-risk patients get a proper TTE from the radiologists as part of their management pathway. Why do we have to be the jack of all trades?
That would probably be the gold standard.
I think maybe it's overkill to have a full radiological examination. That may not influence your management. It's all about your anaesthetic management, your post-operative management that's going to be important. Although they do highlight in the paper the fact these patients have undergone some form of cardiac investigation means that their post-hospital care might be better, so those patients who are picked up and do have a critical stenosis are then referred on to further care. But in answer to your question, I think the relevance in terms of speed and the person giving the anaesthetic, having them do it is in fact probably better. And the limited amount of information, it's the limited amount of information they can get to, in fact, change their management that's important.
But also, I mean, they're probably working with a cohort of anaesthetists who are trained, obviously trained in heart scanning. But and perhaps
well, that was the point and the weakness of this study.
Yeah.
Is that you're selecting for anaesthetists who are giving anaesthetics who are trained in doing heart scanning and then are trained at interpreting the results and altering their anaesthetic accordingly compared to a cohort of patients who are retrospective. This is the massive weakness.
But I think you're right, Rick, in the sense that, and I think most of us, or I've certainly seen that trainees more and more are becoming either interested or feeling obliged to do some sort of focus ultrasound or use ultrasound more, certainly amongst the ICM trainees with courses coming out there. So it's, yeah,
this will be
not
the third or fourth time we've mentioned this point.
Yeah.
But the ultrasound is becoming the stethoscope of this century. And this is what people are going to be using. And what I think's really good about these focused ultrasound courses is that it's not about being an expert. It's about being able to elicit some clinical signs which aid in your diagnosis and therefore management, which is much the way the stethoscope has been used for the century previously.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced. That's like saying that now that microscopes are much better and cheaper, we should start doing our own blood films again, because that way, if we learn to look for a few specific signs, we could quickly aid our diagnostic skills.
So I won't be buying you a TUI test or an ultrasound for Christmas.
Well, I think in a utopian world, yes, you would get a technician or a cardiologist come and do an echo on everyone who was going to have the hip done. But you know, realistically, that's not going to happen.
Why is that not though? They're on the same salary as us, Frank. So it's no better efficiency having us doing these than it is having a registrar in radiology.
Echocardiography is a very dynamic assessment. It needs to be done, especially if you're looking for things like fluid status, it needs to be done imminently before the surgery. And the other thing is, I don't know about you guys, but I find echo reports, a detailed echo report from an experienced echocardiographer, reasonably incomprehensible compared to seeing the images or doing some kind of noddy scan
myself.
Well,
then that tells me you should go on a course about reading the report, not a course about doing the echo yourself.
Absolutely, but the courses will be the same length, and I'll probably get much more benefit and availability for my patients for doing the course for doing some kind of abbreviated course myself, rather than doing a course on interpreting echo.
Well, I think this trial, if it's done properly, should be done with radiologist versus anaesthetist versus nothing.
Interesting you say that. So when I was following up the link on PubMed to the heart scan, the original paper they're talking about, where the authors are linked to, was interpretive. The title is Evaluation of the Interpretive Skills of Participants of a Limited Transthoracic Echocardiography Training Course. And what they've done here is they've looked at some pre-recorded cases and looked at the level of agreement between the people who'd done their course and experts, and found that the level of agreement was essentially very good.
But I think Mark is right. You need to have within one hospital so that you have, whether these anaesthetists are good at looking at scans or what they're good at changing their plans just preoperatively, whatever they are, you need to have those patients randomized so the radiologist scans them, the anaesthetist scans them, or the same anaesthetist doesn't scan them. And they should all be high-risk ASA3 patients with comorbidities. And then they should be looked at again. Because that would be the point, isn't it? Because if we're just as good as the radiologists, then for sheer efficiency of service, we're there. You can just stick the probe on the patient's chest while you're chatting to them, more or less, as opposed to wait for the radiologist to arrive and then take ages and delayed because they're scanning somebody else. So if we are as good, then that's great. And if that, you know, that carries through to the one-year mortality rate, then that'll be amazing. But if the radiologists are going to be better, then that shows that actually it's a waste of our time. Because to keep those skills up to date is a really onerous task.
Well, not if you're doing these things regularly. You're going to keep your skills up to date, aren't you?
But you need to be validated, otherwise you may be making the same mistakes all the time, don't you? You need to make sure that someone who knows what they're looking at is looking at your scans.
We're there all the time, but any time we spend doing this is time we're not spending doing something else. So it's not,
yeah,
it's not free time.
No, this is part of the argument. They did cite some studies. What you're saying is a very common thing that anaesthetists will say, well, the time I'm spending echoing is time I'm not spending gassing. But they've actually quoted two separate studies which have shown that it is totally feasible and this can be done because it is an abbreviated exam in 5 minutes.
That's not my concern. My concern is that a radiologist could do a better job.
But we just don't have the resources for that, do we? I mean, in the same way that we could do a better job giving sedation for all the endoscopies or for any fracture reduction in A&E, but you know, we don't, and other people do, because we don't have the resources to provide that service.
In fact, it probably doesn't make that much of a difference to the outcome.
I don't see where the resources argument comes from, because we're as, if not more, highly paid than an echo technician.
But actually what you want to see is not whose time is the most precious, it's whether does that patient do better and go home quicker, isn't it? Because that's real resource management. If you get them out of the hospital 3 days earlier because you've given a better anaesthetic, you haven't had to do any chest compressions, saved quite a lot of time.
is that your marker of a good anaesthetic?
Yeah, usually. Yeah, I'm really pleased if I'm not scraping the blood pressure off the floor. So, you know, then I think, yeah, they should do a randomized trial and see whose patients. Also, there's more than one way to look at resources. And if it's going to be a, you know, quicker anaesthetic, less ICU time, less outreach time, quicker home, then it's really, you know, you'll have to see who's providing the best resource, you know, use of limited resources.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what these guys come up with, and I'm sure they're working on a study, so
yeah
certainly will be very interesting. But moving on, in an effort to prove he really does never listen to the podcast, we normally send round the articles we're going to talk about prior to recording, so we have at least read them before, even if we still don't know what we're talking about. Well, we all got an article from Mark about an hour ago, followed by an email from Bex 5 minutes later saying that that was a topic we covered only 2 months ago.
I don't think there's no need to name and shame him.
You're quite right. Apologies. So, Mark, what is in the envelope labelled Plan B?
So, yeah, well, I've decided to have a look at something a little bit different than usual, although it was provoked by a typical source. I was reading a letter in this month's BJA from a certain Tim Cook, who I thought had taken an interesting opportunity to write a letter to the BJA in which he publicised about 7 of his own articles from anaesthesia, which Very cleverly done. And so what he's talking about, he was writing in response to an article in last month about litigation in anaesthesia, and he was pointing out for the benefit of the BJA readership that if you're interested in finding out a bit more of this, he published a whole series of analyses back in 2009 when he realized that nobody had really looked at what kind of litigation has been brought in the NHS and in what specialties for what type of incidents and how much is getting paid out. Unlike some other countries, there's no kind of formal mechanism for that stuff to be published and reported on, aside from the kind of circulars we often get from our insurance companies and so on that'll highlight areas. So he back then took it upon himself to approach the NHS Litigation Authority and used their Freedom of Information tools to collect up all the claims and analyse them. And so I just thought I would run through his findings, albeit a few years old now, but just so that we can know what kind of things we're up against. So, background for this issue is that there are surprisingly high reported rates of avoidable iatrogenic harm. The US have published a 4% rate up to Australia, who've reported a 17% rate. Published rates in the UK of iatrogenic harm are between 9 and 11%, but up to half of those are deemed avoidable. And straight away to me that sounds like a huge amount. This is 9 to 11% of all hospital admissions having some kind of iatrogenic harm. So this all gets dealt with at the moment by the NHS Litigation Authority, and they within that have several schemes for different types of claim, and the main one that's relevant to the clinical claims is the CNST, or Clinical Negligence Scheme for Trusts. And this seems to me to be some kind of insurance scheme almost. They call it a risk pooling scheme, whereby all of the UK trusts or English trusts contribute to the Clinical Negligence Scheme for Trusts, and that pot of money is from where the payouts come. So they receive about 5,000 clinical and 3,000 non-clinical claims per year, each one taking an average of 1.5 years to settle. So big sums of money involved. At the time when Dr. Cook did his research, he looked at the period of time between 1995 and 2007. And in 2007, the cost of the Clinical Negligence Scheme for Trusts was £425 million. Although looking at the website for the NHS Litigation Authority, I can see that for the financial year just gone, 11-12, the cost of payouts was over £1 billion. So frightening amounts of money. So to the numbers from Tim Cook's analysis, he says that between 1995 and 2007, anaesthesia represented around 2.5% of a total of just over 40,000 claims. So about 1,000 claims were labelled as anaesthesia-related. He excluded quite a few that were deemed to be misclassified or more correctly should have belonged to ICU or pain, and another handful that just didn't have enough clinical information for analysis, and reviewed 841 cases. So the biggest risk areas he found were 44% of these claims were relating to regional anaesthesia, 29% to obstetric anaesthesia, 19% to inadequate anaesthesia, 11% to dental damage, and 8% to airway-related problems. These costing more than £30 million over that 12-year period. All fairly predictable areas. The good news is that this is only a 40th of the total amount of claims, both in number and in cost.
Did it say who was the most common speciality?
Obs and gynae. And then surgery.
Oh, really?
Yeah, O&G, then surgery, then medicine, then emergency medicine, then us.
Well, that's quite nice to know we're quite far down the list.
Yeah, and if you look at the, you know, scale-wise, not only fifth down the list, but significantly less than it is. Like I say, 2.5%, both in volume of cases and in cost involved. There's lots of numbers in this analysis, and Dr. Cook does go into quite some detail to explain that the data set being collected by the NHS Litigation Authority doesn't lend itself well to clinical analysis of what might have gone wrong and what might be done to help. But this is data is collected mainly for the legal processing of the claims, but still, it's good to know what we're up against, and it's very interesting reading. And he, after this kind of this summary that I'm talking about here was published in Anesthesia in 2009, but he then went on over the following months to look at each of these areas in more depth, and far too much to talk about now, but quite interesting reading. So I recommend that. Well, the letter in this month's BGA contains all the references, so if you're interested in reading some more, that is a good place to start.
There is a an article that came out in the Canadian Journal of Anesthesia from March this year, and they had a, it was written by a Canadian, but they don't have a retirement age here, and anaesthetists can carry on working until they want to retire. And it's not uncommon to have anaesthetists in their, you know, mid to late 70s that are carrying on working. And it was an article which I thought was, we have quite a young chief in our department, and I thought it was, you know, a little cheeky that he sent this to all the anesthesiologists in the whole of University of Toronto. So it's Toronto General, the Sick Kids Hospital, Mount Sinai, and the Women's Hospital. And it shows very clearly that actually your risk of having a, of being sued, is of having sort of successful litigation against you, is it plateaus, you know, really early on in your career. You hardly get sued, and then at about age 60 it suddenly takes a little curve and it looks literally like a drain pipe. But after 65 your risk just skyrockets. And what was really interested in me in this article is that never once did they say, oh, look how in other countries they have a retirement age. They talked about how necessary it was that they studied why these why there was this higher risk of complications and litigation, and what could be done about it. Where I just thought, just enforce the retirement age.
That's, it's weird, isn't it? How in this country everybody's really annoyed at the moment that the retirement age is being pushed up, and yet in Canada they don't seem to want one at all.
I'm all for the retirement age.
I certainly think it makes a, it makes very good sense for people in practically based specialties.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that, Mark. A very successfully deployed backup plan. Now, if you're anything like me, you're probably constantly irritated by our atopic nation and the hysteria surrounding poorly documented or investigated drug allergies. But Frank, you're going to tell us about a paper that is hopefully going to lay at least one of these myths to rest.
Thanks, Rick. Well, yeah, this irks me as well, and more recently, I suppose, because I've been paying more attention and working independently. Obviously, we all ask patients if they're allergic to anything, but I'm sure all of us are well aware of how prevalent penicillin allergy seems to be out there, and that you really can't believe that that's the case. I mean, most people think that penicillin allergic, someone in the family was penicillin allergic, or they got given penicillin as a child, and they're now therefore allergic. And obviously, the argument that follows on from that is that if you're penicillin allergic, well, there's a risk of cross-reactivity with cephalosporins. And I don't know what everyone else was taught, but I seem to remember at med school we were told there was about a 15% cross-reactivity. And then a few years ago, for some reason, I seem to remember a number of around 7 or 8%. I never really knew or investigated where that had come from.
It was 10 for me.
So,
yeah,
was it 10?
10.
Yeah.
You can gauge when someone went to med school by what they think the cross-reactivity with cephalosporins is.
It ages you.
Yeah, for Frank it's 15. For, you know, us it's about 10. If you ask an F1, F2 nowadays, they'll probably say 3 or 4.
So, first of all, I've got to give a shout-out to Adam Fendius, who listens to the podcast, and he posted a link to a blog, actually, called Academic Life in Emergency Medicine. I'll give you the links for that. And one of the guys who writes it actually authored this article, and it saves anyone who's interested in this the work of doing the literature review. And essentially just published a literature review on use of cephalosporins in penicillin-allergic patients. And I won't dwell on it too much, but they did a reasonably thorough review. They introduced the article by saying that cross-reactivity back in the 60s and 70s was reported anywhere between 8 and 18%. And that then led on to interclinical practice, that people mostly avoided cephalosporins in patients who claimed to be penicillin allergic, even if it was indicated as a first-line therapy. They did a midline search and essentially found 406 articles, and I won't go through all the exclusions, but boiled that down to 27 articles that were read and evaluated. And the paper does discuss a few of the important ones in that a bit more, but again, I don't think it's worth spending too much time on that. The bits that are important are that, and I didn't know this because I always tell FY1s and medical students that the reason that penicillin allergic patients are allergic to cephalosporins or carbapenems is because of the beta-lactam ring. I don't know if anyone else uses that
probably. Yeah, all the time.
But in fact, it's cross-reactivity was shown to be due to the R1 side chain of the beta-lactam ring and not due to the beta-lactam ring at all. So that's refreshed my knowledge on it. And there's a couple of studies where investigators actually gave penicillin-allergic patients cephalosporins, and a lot of the data of what has been shown in that is what they talk about in the article. In one study, 128 penicillin-allergic patients who had proper allergies, who had either anaphylactic shock or urticaria, had skin testing, and very few of those had skin reactions. The other point that the article makes is that most reactions are due to first and second generation cephalosporins, and I would challenge you. Actually, there is one second generation cephalosporin we still use, but I would challenge you to be able to name a first generation cephalosporin that we still commonly use in the UK. Just backtracking a bit, but I should have mentioned that there was a quite differing articles that they looked at. So there were two meta-analyses, 14 cohort studies, two surveys, 9 in vitro studies, and those are the ones that made up the 27 articles. So quite varied evidence, but it, as I said, I think, you know, looking at what is out there, they did a good job of fishing out the important bits. So in some of the large retrospective cohort studies, again, these had reasonably big numbers, 606 patients who had a history of penicillin allergy and who had received cephalosporins. And only one of those patients, that's 0.17%, actually had an adverse reaction. And there are a few other studies like that that they go on to quote. So in their discussion, they just say that their literature review does indicate that cross-reactivity between penicillins and cephalosporins is way overestimated, and it's much lower than what is commonly quoted, and they call it the 10% rule, as you did as well. They also criticized early studies, saying that they loosely defined the term of allergy and didn't account for the fact that patients who had penicillin allergies would increase risks of adverse reactions in any case, and that true penicillin allergies, i.e. IgE-mediated type 1 allergic responses, are very, very much rarer. Then they say that true incidence of allergy penicillin is in patients who report having penicillin allergy is less than 10%, and that's one of the sort of take-home messages. So even of patients who say that they are penicillin allergic, probably less than 10% of those actually have true allergy. They also quoted an international survey that said found that the incidence of anaphylaxis after being given penicillin was as low as 0.015 to 0.004%, and obviously a fatality rate of even less than that.
So are there any first generation cephalosporins that we still use in the UK?
I can't really think of any first generation ones. I mean, the ones that they quote in the study are specifically those that have R1 side chains,
yeah,
that are closely related to amoxicillin and ampicillin, and those are things like cefaclor, cefalexin, cefridine, which I can't remember the last time I saw a prescription for that. I think they do use it in peds still, because it's an oral cephalosporin preparation.
So none of the ones we give, basically, will react. That's what I want to know.
But I think cefuroxime is a second generation, isn't it? Is anyone?
Yeah.
Can anyone back me up or refute that?
Isn't it true that you can tell by the name. So the third generations all have a T in them. Because the ceftriaxone and ceftazidine the third generation. And I think there's,
I'm just
there's something similar.
Yeah, they are third generation, so you might...
That's an interesting point. We should probably look that up and get that right.
I'm just looking it up
really?
Now.
Why are we going to start now?
When I don't... I'm very happy that we know this now. Oh, I've just looked at it. Ceftriaxone is a second generation.
Hang on, let me just get Wikipedia. That's the quick way to answer this.
Quick and accurate.
It's as accurate
so I've
as
ruthlessly
me doing
given
my own
people
ultrasound.
Who are allergic to penicillin. I've been giving them ceftriaxone for ages, which now I feel better about. But what is great to know is it's not actually whether you give the ceftriaxone or not. It's the release. It's not having to give the vancomycin, because vancomycin is one of the worst drugs to give, I think. I've had two people I know from my anaesthetic career that have got really bad red band syndrome, even if I've given it incredibly slowly over 2 hours. People have turned really red, profound vasodilation. It's a really awful drug. I think that's the incidence of that is much higher.
But
than...
it's not just that. Anything ending in myosin, erythromycin, for instance, are awful drugs. And Frank, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. But thank you much more, Campagna, Bond, Schabelman, and Hayes, for doing the hard work for us in what's essentially a very boring question, but has for several years taken up a massive amount of my headspace when a patient has told me they've got a penicillin allergy. I've asked them what it is, and they've said, oh, it's a rash that I had when I was a toddler, and my GP has always avoided that, and therefore he's done X, Y, and Z, and they're coming in for some sort of orthopedic procedure, and therefore we have to break out the teicoplanin, and it costs money to the NHS, and probably morbidity and side effects from using an antibiotic, in fact, has other problems with it, as opposed to using a bog-standard penicillin, which they probably would have been all right with, but then not being able to use a cephalosporin, because I'm with a believer in cross-reactivity. This is a fantastic piece of work. It's boring, but it's fantastic. So thank you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they end off by saying that the overall cross-reactivity between cephalosporins and penicillins in patients who report a penicillin allergy is just 1%. And those who actually have a confirmed penicillin allergy, so IgE changes and proper reactions, is 2.5%. So certainly a lot lower. And that patients who have anaphylactic reaction or anaphylactoid reaction to drugs or to cephalosporin are much more likely to just be reacting to that cephalosporin rather than it being a penicillin cross reaction.
Interesting, on Wikipedia it says that cefazolin, which is our ANSEF that I use in Canada at the moment, is a first generation cephalosporin. So I wonder if I should still be wary.
So you better not give that to your penicillin allergic patients.
You guys are kind of backward over there, eh?
Oh, it's like the 90s, yep.
You're listening to Brian Adams, Crash Test Dummies, eh?
You do the A well, Rick.
Something like that.
Reduce our three runs.
Right, let's do biology or bunkum. I'm going to win.
Let's do it. I think what I just said about the naming of cephalosporins was essentially bunkum. there is some truth to it, but it's fairly complicated. It's not as simple as I thought. There is a convention for naming them based on what generation they're in, but it's not a kind of simple mnemonic.
Excellent. So, Bex, yes, we should move on to biology or bunkum. You didn't listen to last month's podcast, so you won't be aware of your score.
Oh. You can't... Last month can't possibly be included unless Sibs was any good.
Right, so no bias there at all, but you'll be... but anyway, I won.
So Sibs was a dud, so I think that score has to be discarded.
It doesn't get discarded, it just means that it doesn't really change the leaderboard, seeing as I infrequently win. So for this month's Biology of Bunkum, it's your usual three news stories, there's no particular theme. So, number one. As I'm sure you're all aware, the humble fruit fly is the lab rat of choice for experimental geneticists. Researchers in Cambridge have managed to hack the genome of Drosophila and coax it into producing proteins that don't exist in nature using hitherto unknown amino acid sequences. They've produced a protein that makes the abdominal exoskeleton of the fly 12% tougher and nicknamed it the bulletproof fly. Number two, more genetics. You're probably aware of the natural and rare phenomenon of tetragametic chimerism, where one egg is fertilized by two sperm from a single male parent, giving rise to a viable organism with organs derived from different cell lines, which leads to inconsistent DNA profiling. This was, in fact, part of the storyline in the fail that was Mission Impossible 2. Scientists in the US have gone one step further and managed to create a set of viable embryos from three distinctly different human parents, so, in effect, trimerism. And your third story. We've all had communication problems with significant others, but research published in the Journal of Biological Psychiatry has demonstrated that the answer is intranasal oxytocin for both parties. In a double-blind, placebo-controlled design, couples were given intranasal oxytocin or placebo... Sorry. In a double-blinded, placebo-controlled design, couples were given intranasal oxytocin or placebo before... Sorry. In a double-blind, placebo-controlled design, couples were given intranasal oxytocin or placebo before a standard instructed couple conflict discussion in the laboratory, and the result demonstrated an increase in positive communication behavior in the oxytocin group. Which one of those is biology, and which is a figment of my imagination?
Excellent. Well, that last one, if you'd made it up, you presumably would have been able to say it. So I think that must be true. I'm going to say the fruit fly is bunkum because it sounds a bit like one of your X-Men fantasies to me.
Okay, reasonable reasoning. Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Mark. I'm going to go with the fruit fly business being bunkum, mainly because I don't think... No, well, partly. mainly because I don't think people would have spent time to decode the genome of the fruit fly. I think we've had enough trouble doing the human one. I don't think we would have had the funding.
That's not the reason. That's definitely been done.
No, definitely.
Are you joking with that?
Oh, don't upset
Rick. Of all reasons for picking that one, that has got to be the worst one. I mean, I think one of the first organisms to have its genome sequenced was Drosophila.
Yeah, I think they could do that on a Nokia 3210.
Okay. So my thinking may not be right, but maybe it's my gut instinct. We'll see. It'll all be revealed. I'm sticking with the fruit fly. Have they seriously decoded its genes? A fruit fly.
Yes, yeah, I think that was
human
one of the first ones they did.
Took a long time, but now they can do it in a couple of days for it.
They could do yours in about 24 hours.
I saw Richard Dawkins having his done on telly the other week.
Fine, okay, let's move on.
We should do that ourselves as part of our preoperative assessment. That
be more useful than a focused echocardiography.
I feel Mark's going to have a rant all ready to go next time.
So, Frank, what do you reckon?
I'm going to go... I think the oxytocin is bunkum. Even though you tripped and fell all over that.
I'm hoping that was true, because it's very easy to steal.
Fair enough. So, no one went for the tetragametic chimerism, which was quite correct. That is indeed a genuine phenomenon. So tetragametic chimerism is where one egg is fertilized from two sperm from a single parent. But I'm sure you're all aware of the horrific mitochondrial metabolic syndromes that can occur in humans. And one of the ways that researchers have got around that is to basically break eggs apart and take out the mitochondrial DNA from the egg, leaving the original DNA, and then plug in the mitochondrial DNA from someone else, another mother essentially, because that's where it comes from, and then fertilize that with a sperm. So you do have an embryo which is derived from three genetically different individuals.
That's very cool.
That is very cool. In something that's slightly less cool, they've had to destroy those embryos. But it is technically possible. So for people with mitochondrial metabolic syndromes, which are, I think, by and large, reasonably lethal, that is now something that can be conquered, which is great news. So, moving on to number one, which was the bulletproof fly. That is, in fact, the bunkum.
Oh. Mark, but you only... let me down.
Bex, you said that was bunkum. You're right.
You should be stripped from your point for copying me.
Sorry.
Bex, once again, you've misunderstood how the game works, but you've won, so well done.
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I thought Mark had let me down. I was so just devastated about the humiliation of the fly genome that...
Number of people who neither listen to this podcast nor apparently pay attention while we're actually recording to it.
Understand the rules.
Or understand the rules of the game we play. But yes, this is in fact bunkum. Although there's more than a grain of truth to it. So researchers in Cambridge have in fact managed to hack the genome of Drosophila.
And Rebecca, seriously, Drosophila. The genome has been mapped out for at least a decade.
I was listening to AHA and Rick Astley when they were doing this.
I had wallpaper of it in my childhood bedroom.
And this is why anyway, I am not XY chromosome.
In the way that your CATG parts of your genome refer to various amino acids, which obviously get plugged together to make proteins, researchers have managed to use different combinations of amino acids to make proteins that were hitherto unknown, which is where I was hoping to catch you out, Mark, because you have commented on how my use of English has revealed to you, which one is the bunkum.
I am familiar with that kind of work going on, but it was when you were talking about the body armor that I just...
You said too much.
You're right. I went a step too far. Basically, the article was saying they have managed to do this and make the Drosophila produce proteins that aren't natural proteins and are therefore synthetic. However, they've done it in a really non-impressive way. They've made sort of the tissue of the ovaries produce three proteins that... you know, aren't kind of real proteins, and then they've given birth stuff. It's all very exciting. And at the end, they postulate that one could invent a bulletproof fly, but yes, sadly, no one's done it. So yeah, I probably gave myself away there. That was the bunkum. And Frank, yes, oxytocin has long been known as the drug of harmony, and it has been intranasally delivered for some time. This article that I'm actually quoting came from something else, and this was a reference from the article. So this is actually a paper in the Journal of Biological Psychiatry from 2009, where they have got couples to have an argument. What's really interesting about this paper, and obviously I don't have access to it, I've just got access to the PubMed abstract, but it says that they did indeed put the couples into a standard instructed couple conflict discussion in the laboratory, and then gave them either intranasal oxytocin or intranasal placebo, and oxytocin significantly increased positive communication behavior in relation to negative communication behavior during the couple conflict discussion.
I didn't think you could have made up a standardized couple conflict discussion. I'd love to see what that is.
I would love to see what that is. I mean, that's almost, that's definitely worth paying for that paper to see what that was all about. Interestingly, the article that I sort of bounced to that from was something which I thought you'd recognise as probably biology, because there's no way someone could have made this up. In Germany, colleagues have given men either a sniff of oxytocin or placebo before asking them to choose the ideal distance for interaction with a woman. The distance that they felt, the man this is, was comfortable significantly increased after sniffing oxytocin, but only for men in relationships.
Now we just have to watch the stock levels of oxytocin at Mark's hospital.
Yeah, start doing some experimenting on my own. Before I embark on my next standardized couple conflict discussion.
Maybe you could see if intranasal syntocinon makes midwife anaesthetist conflicts end better.
Just start carrying an aerosol around. Just macing them in the face with oxytocin.
Well, we look forward to being able to purchase weaponized oxytocin from Salmon Industries in the not-too-distant future. That's the end of this month's podcast. We'll be back next month with our Christmas episode, and we will perhaps, if we can schedule it, be joined by a surprise special guest. So see you then, and thanks for listening.